Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Sonia Sanchez. Sonia Sanchez is the author of over 16 books, including Homegirls and Hand Grenades, just re-released by White Pine Press, which won an American Book Award from the Before Columbus Foundation, Shake Loose My Skin, New and Selected Poems, Like the Singing Comes Off the Drums, Love Poems, and Does Your House Have Lions, which was nominated for both the NAACP Image and National Book Critics Circle Award. Her published plays include Black Cats and Uneasy Landings. She has edited anthologies and won many, many awards for her writing and revolutionary work in the world. Sonia Sanchez began teaching in the San Francisco area in 1965 and was a pioneer in developing Black Studies courses at what is now San Francisco State University. She was the first to create and teach a course based on Black women and literature in the United States here at the University of Pittsburgh in 1969. She was the first presidential fellow at Temple University, where she began working in 1977 and held the Laura Carnell Chair until her retirement in 1999. She is currently a poet in residence at Temple University. Sonia Sanchez has read her poetry in Africa, the Caribbean, China, Australia, Europe, Nicaragua, Canada, and Cuba. She is the sponsor of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, a recipient of the National Endowment for the Arts, the Lucretia Mott Award, and a Pew Fellowship in the Arts. She was the Poetry Society of America's 2001 Robert Frost Medalist, a Ford Freedom Scholar, and a recipient of the Ottawa Award. And Sonia Sanchez is in town thanks to the Pittsburgh Cultural Trust. Welcome. How are you doing?
Fine. I'm okay. I've been talking all morning, so it seems. And last night, I actually literally talked for about 8 hours. So I've been talking a lot.
Okay. Right. We're going to ask you to talk for just a little more here on the air.
I can do that. Okay. I can do that.
If you wouldn't mind reading some poems to begin with. And then,
sure.
Okay.
I'll do maybe a slight retrospective. And in class today here at Pitt, I did a poem for my father. And the poem I talked about, this was the first poem I'd written for my father, so it was a very harsh poem. And later on in Does Your House Have Lions, I do a poem, a section called Father's Voice, where you begin to see a different kind of look at my father. A poem for my father. How sad it must be to love so many women, to need so many black perfume bodies weeping underneath you. When I remember all those nights I fill my mind with long wars between short-sighted Trojans and Greeks while you slap some wide hips about in your private dungeon. When I remember your deformity, I want to do something about your makeshift manhood, I guess. That is why on meeting your sixth wife, I cross myself with her confessionals. And so that's a poem that I did for my dad. And when I told him I was doing a book about his son, my brother, my father said, well, oh, good, good. You can't do a book about your brother, my son, without talking about me, including me. And I thought for a minute, you know, I was there at his house. I was taking care of him at that time. I took care of him for 6 years during the time he was ill. And I said simply, yeah, I guess maybe you're right. I do need to include you. In fact, I said, your son, my brother, has been insinuating himself in the story that I'm telling about his life. And he's demanding a voice also, too. So I had actually gone from the sister's voice to the brother's voice. And now I realize I had to do a father's voice also. So that poem, and my dad said to me that day in his house in New York City, he said, what you never understood is that that I, the only woman I ever loved was your mother. My mom died giving birth to twins. He said, the rest of the women I had were accoutrements. So I kind of set up at that point and said, please explain yourself. And he began to tell me that the rest of the people, really, they were okay, but they never could quite be what my mother had been to him. So it kind of changed my whole look at all those women that he had had, you know, later on. So then I would do a poem then called in my book, Does Your House of Lions, which says Father's Voice, which begins to look at him in a different fashion, in a different way. And I'd like to read. And that this book is done in Rhyme Royal, Does Your House of Lions. And, you know, for your audience, you know, Rhyme Royal is seven lines. And the rhyme scheme is A, B, A, B, B, C, C. So I then very calmly, you know, began to do this section. And the section that I put my father in, interestingly enough, was the section where he talks about his son coming to my house in Philadelphia. My brother would come down to my house many weekends, and he would walk in, and the first thing he did would curse our father. And for years he did it, and when he was younger, I would let him do it. But one day he hits my house in his early 30s, and I thought, come on, you're too old for this. You know, you're too old for, you know, cursing our father. And he said, I can curse him any way, any place I want to. I said, well, not in my house anymore. And so he did it. And so I shook him. And we sort of fell together on the floor. And I sang to him about his mother and how she had mistreated my sister and me. But I also told him that how his father did not really want to leave him. But he did that separation because of the mistreatment of his sisters. And it was a different moment. You know, my brother would then leave the house and that Sunday and go up to my father's place in New York City and ask forgiveness. So it's a reconciliation. And when, you know, two members in the family reconcile, the entire family reconciles. So this is what my father will say. The day he traveled to my daughter's house, it was June. He cursed me with his morning nod of anger as he filtered his callous walk, skip, hop, feet slipshod from 125th Street bars, face curled with odd reflections. The skin of a father is accented in the sentence of the unaccented. And then my father would talk about his life. I was a Southern Negro man playing music, married to a high yellow woman who loved my unheard face, who slept with me in Nordic beauty. I, prisoner since my birth to fear, I unfashioned, buried in an open grave of mornings unclapped with constant sight of master's fattened deck with my diminished light. And then he talks about my mother. This love, this first wife of mine died in childbirth. This face of complex lace exiled her breath into another design. And I died, became wanderlust, demanded recompense from friends for my heartbreak, cursed the land for this new heartache, put her away with a youthful pause, never called her name again, wrapped my heart in gauze. And then he talks about becoming a ladies' man, that which I wrote about in my early years, became Romeo-bound, applauded women as I squeezed their syrup, drank their stencil face, danced between their legs, placed my swollen shank to the world, became man distilled, early 20th century black man fossil, fulfilled by women things for closing on my life. Mother, where do I go before I arrive? Then he talks about my brother's mother. She wasn't as beautiful as my first wife, this ruby-colored girl, insinuating her limb against my thigh, positioning her wild life, her non-virgin smell as virginal. Her climb towards me with slow-walking heels made me limp, made me stumble, made my legs squint until I stopped steps inside her footprint. And then he asked forgiveness of his son. I did not want to leave you, son. This flame, this pecan-colored festival requested me, not my child, your sister. Your mother could not frame herself as her mother, and I, absentee father, and I, nightclub owner carefree, did not heed her blood, did not see my girl's eyes shave buckle down with southern thighs. Now my 78 years urge me on your land. Now my predator legs pray broadcast no new nightmares. No longer birdmen of cornerstone comes. I come to collapse the past while bonfires burn up your orphan's mask. I sing a dirge of lost black southern manhood, this Harlem man begging pardon, secreting old. And he goes on talking about my brother's visit in the house. Now, he was not there, But, you know, he has to say, I was told, you know, I assumed this happened, whatever, et cetera, the battle. And I do battle for my, it's a battle for my brother's soul. My brother was a gay young man, and I was battling for him because he had not reconciled himself to being gay. So he went to these bars, and I used to go and pull him out the bars in New York City. And I'm saying to him, you got to love yourself. Appreciate the person you are, who you are. And we love you. I love you. So therefore, we're satisfied with the person you are. And my brother would leave the house. We would spend a weekend, an interesting weekend, talking about his life, and I talk about his mother. But he would leave my my house and go to my father's house and say the following, brother's voice, there is nothing I do not comprehend. I have become a collector of shouts. Hold my ears, Father. I have come to mend our hearts, raise a glass, celebrate, root out lyrical slaughters, become your only son devout. I have become a lover of sweet water. I worship stone. I will not betray you, Father. And the Father's voice would say then, steady your hand, old man. Do not trouble yourself with language. Stalk his wound. He is listening to your corpuscles, cradle the clap and thunder of a new sound. He has called your name and old teeth are found. Can you hold me, son, as I rise from this whimper? Can you hear me, son, as I cross over this river? And so the two of them reconcile, which is an amazing moment for me and the family.
You just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Sonia Sanchez. I know that from hearing you before and from reading your work that there's so much about transformation, peace, reconciliation going on, almost regardless of the content of your poems.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's in the family, whether it's in the larger world. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about your poetry as related to that movement towards, it seems like it's always moving towards peace for you.
Well, I think so. Although, you know, when we first started to write this thing that we do called poetry, you know, we had discovered that this country had kept us away from our history and herstory. So we came out cursing everybody on the planet Earth, you know. And I remember someone said to me once, a brother who worked for the Times, you know, you really took the time to task. I said, I took everybody to task, you know. Everyone who had this information and didn't share this information at all with us. And we had to go and excavate it, you know, from the libraries, you know, from all these places, from cities, in order to find and discover exactly, you know, who it was that we were. So, of course, the early poems were poems that talked about America. The early poems talked about the Vietnam War. The poems I do now are talking about peace and bringing our young people and our older people home from this war in Iraq also, too. Saying very simply, so in that, you know, I was arrested in Philadelphia in June of 06 with 10 other women. We grandmothers went in, some grandmothers and women went in to say to the recruitment officers, take us. Do not take our children and our grandchildren and our granddaughters and grandsons and our aunts and our uncles and our and above all our children. Take us. And of course they said, well, no. So we said, you know, well, let's have a conversation while we're here. And we sat down and started this conversation with the recruiters. And started a conversation with the young men and women who were in there, you know, filling out these applications. And I asked one of the young men, a young black man, I said, why are you coming in here to join up? He said, well, they told me that if I come in here and do this, I could become a doctor, too. And I thought to myself, by golly, by gee, you know, I doubt that quite seriously, if they're going to do that, you know, for you. And I said, you know, I know a lot of people at UPenn, at Temple University, at universities, we could probably get you involved with a program that can help you become a doctor. And he stopped filling out the application. He stopped and looked at me and said, really? His only idea of raising himself up was the army, you know, like a lot of people of color, you know, and a lot of young poor whites, you know, and a lot of the servicemen who are serving in Iraq, you know, that volunteer army, those young men and women, you know, you know, who are in the reserve because it pays for their education, and never thought they would be, they would end up in a place called Iraq fighting a war that they probably, we all aren't really, in a sense, prepared for. But anyway, you know, so we were arrested, and then they took us to court the next day, and the next day the judge said trial. Now, usually you're charged with trespass, so they kind of slap you on the hand, say, go. If you don't do anything else for 6 months, you know, you're okay, right, whatever. But what they did this time is that they charged us with something called defiant trespass. And that has its own little series of laws, mm-hmm. by the way. So we gave us a court date of December 1st. And we showed up in court 11 strong on December 1st. And we had supporters came from various universities, Williams College. Students got in a van at 1 o'clock in the morning and got there in Philly at 8 o'clock. Students from Washington, D.C. and New York City and, of course, Philadelphia, they came out to support us. And we introduced ourselves in the courtroom. And then the judge was a real brilliant black woman. Very smart, very, 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 very smart, very bright woman, young woman, who asked the prosecutor to show how we were involved with each section of the law that was a defined trespass. And all the prosecutor said, kept saying was that, well, they came in, they sat in, they talked, and they sat in, they wouldn't leave, and they were asked to leave. That was it. And so she went and read the law, the second part of the law, and she asked it in the same fashion. And so she said, well, you have not proved defiant trespass as the law says. And so she dismissed the charges, and the people in the courtroom clapped, and she turned and said, this is not television. This is the courtroom. This is my courtroom. If you want to applaud those women, go outside my courtroom. You know, she had control of her courtroom, mm-hmm. right? And so all those people who had come in from far away, I brought them to my home and cooked them some good food, you know, and sent them on their way. But what was so nice was the cross-generational thing that was going there. Mm-hmm. These young people understanding that they are responsible for what happens to mm-hmm. them in this country, in the world, that they don't sit back and let people and be victims and think that at some point they have no control over anything right. at all. So that was a joy.
That's great. Mm-hmm. Would you read some more poems?
I'd love to. I'd like to read a poem that I did for Martin Luther King, because I just did a couple of months ago, a poem for Martin, and I did a lecture on Martin Luther King. And I talked a lot about his speech that he gave at Riverside Church, which was an amazing speech where he came out against the war officially, and many people had asked him not to do that. And many of us applauded him in such a fashion because, you know, many of the poets had been against the war, the Vietnam War, for a long, long time and had suffered the consequences of that also, too. So this is called Morning Song and Evening Walk for MLK 1. Tonight in need of you and God, I move imperfect through this ancient city, quiet. No one hears, no one fears the tears of multitudes. The silence thickens. I have lost the shore of your kind seasons. Who will hear my voice, nasal against distinguished actors? Oh, I am tired of voices without sound. I will rest on this ground full of mass hymns, too. You have been here since I can remember, Martin. From Selma to Montgomery, from Watts to Chicago, from Nobel Peace Prize to Memphis, Tennessee, unmoved among the angles and corners of aristocratic confusion. It was a time to be born face forward, a time to wander inside drums, the good time with eyes like stars and soldiers without medals or weapons, but honor, yes, yes. And you told us the storm is rising against the privileged minority of the earth from which there is no shelter in isolation or armament, and you told us the storm will not abate until a just distribution of the fruits of the earth enables men and women everywhere to live in dignity and human decency. 3. All summer long it has rained, and the waters rise in our throats, and all that we sing is rumored forgotten. Whom shall we call when this song comes of age? And they came into the city, carrying their fastings in their eyes. And the young 9-year-old Sudanese boy said, I want something to eat at night, a place to sleep. And they came into the city, hands salivating, guns. And the young 9-year-old word snapped red with vows. Mama, 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 auntie, auntie, I dead. For in our city of lost alphabets, where only our eyes strengthen the children, you spoke like Peter, like John, you fishermen of tongues, untangling our wings, you inaugurated iron for our masks, exile no one with your touch, and we felt the thunder in your hands. We are soldiers in the army. We have to fight, although we have to cry. We have to hold up the freedom banners. We have to hold it up until we die. And you said, we must keep going, and we became small miracles, push the wind down, enter the slow bloodstream of America, surround the streets and reconcentradas, tune our legs against Olympic politicians, elaborate cadavers growing fat underneath Western hats, and we scrape the rust from old laws, went floor by floor, window by window, and clean faces rose from the dust, became new brides and bridegrooms among change, men and women coming for their inheritance, and you challenge us to catch up with our own breaths, to breathe in Latinos, Asians, Native Americans, whites, blacks, gays, lesbians, Muslims, and Jews, to gather up our rainbow-colored skins in peace and racial justice as we try to answer your long-ago question, is there a non-violent peacemaking army that can shut down the Pentagon? And you challenge us to breathe in Bernard Herring's words, the materialistic growth mania for more and more production and more markets for selling unnecessary and even damaging products is a sin against the generation to come. What shall we leave to them? Rubbish, atomic weapons, numerous enough to make the earth uninhabitable. A poison atmosphere, polluted water. 5. Love in practice is a harsh and dreadful thing compared to love in dreams, said a Russian writer. Now I know at great cost, Martin, that as we burn, something moves out of the flames, called a spirit or apparition, till no fire or body or ash remain. We breathe out and smell the world again. Hey, 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 yo, 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 amen, hey woman, amen, hey woman, amen, hey woman, amen, amen, hey woman, amen, 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 hey woman, hey woman. A woman, amen, a woman, amen, a woman.
You just tuned in. You're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Sonia Sanchez. It seems like, you know, clearly from the very beginning, poetry has been a revolutionary act. The writing of poetry has been a revolutionary act tied to your life in the world. And I wonder, you've been doing this for a long time. I wonder, you know, what sustains you? There have been so many poets who stop, or so many poets who now sort of fade away. What sustains you? I mean, you keep traveling and going, and right. We're really grateful for that. But
what sustains me is that the people, you know, this looking at the people, knowing the people as Whitman has known the people, as Baraka has known the people, you know, as Morrison has known the people, as June Jordan and Audre Lorde have known the people. It's the people, you know, that you look at, and the students we have taught, you look into their eyes and you see, they come there and you give them hope and you make them understand that this is their earth, this is their land, this is their earth, this is their country, this is their world, and they must demand more of the people who run it. I try to do that with them, to make sure that on many levels they begin to look at the world, as companion, as a place that they must nurture, as a place that they must continue to give water to, so therefore it will survive and live and sustain us all. And the other thing, too, is that, when we stumble upon ourselves in this country, when we found out exactly what had happened to our ancestors in here, of course we'd be very angry. But if you continue just being angry and you write just angry things at some point, although there were soft things we wrote too, but this angry kind of thing, you really don't move and evolve. At least in my head, you don't. The body will stay the same. But we've got to evolve and say some other things too in another voice to involve people in this whole discussion about what it means to be human. The question we attempted to ask, to answer rather, in the 20th century is, what does it mean to be human, my sister? And that question follows us into the 21st century. What does it mean to be human? What does it mean to act and walk upright as a human being? You know, that means you don't fight wars. That means you don't discriminate. That means you don't call people names. That means you don't try to kill gays and lesbians. That means that you go into a classroom and teach Black and Puerto Rican children. You teach them what you know. You don't let them sit there and not learn. It means simply at some particular point that you begin to nurture this earth, you know, and the waters, that you clean up like Pittsburgh is cleaned up. You clean up a city. You can clean up. When I lived here, it was so polluted here, I coughed every day. I couldn't stop coughing. You know, so it's possible to clean up a city. It's possible to clean up the rivers. It's possible to do that.
We have time for one poem.
Okay. A short poem or a long poem?
Short poem, I think.
Shortish, maybe long enough for Sweet Honey in the Rock, the poem that I love them. And I have read with them and recorded with them. I'm going to stay on the battlefield. I'm going to stay on the battlefield. I'm going to stay on the battlefield till I die. I'm going to stay on the battlefield. I'm going to stay on the battlefield. I'm going to stay on the battlefield till I die. I had come into the city carrying life in my eyes amid rumors of death, calling out to everyone who would listen. It is time to move us all into another century. Time for freedom and racial and sexual justice. Time for women and children and men, time for hands unbound. I had come into the city wearing peaceful breasts and the spaces between a smile. I had come into the city carrying life in my eyes. I had come into the city carrying life in my eyes. And they follow us in their cars with their computers, and their tongues crawl with caterpillars, and they bumped us off the road, turned over our cars, and they bombed our buildings, killed our babies, and they shot our doctors, maintaining our bodies, and their courts changed into confessionals. But we kept on organizing. We kept on teaching, believing, loving, doing what was holy, moving to a higher ground, even though our hands were full of slaughtered teeth. But we held out our eyes, delirious with grace. But we held out our eyes, delirious with grace. I'm going to treat everybody right. I'm going to treat everybody right. I'm going to treat everybody right till I die. I'm going to treat everybody right. I'm going to treat everybody right. I'm going to treat everybody right till I die. Come. I say, come, you sitting still in domestic bacteria, come. I say, come, you standing still in double-breasted mornings. Come, I say, come, and return to the fight. This fight for the earth, this fight for our children, this fight for our life. We need your hurricane voices. We need your sacred hands. I say, come, sister, brother, to the battlefield. Come into the rainforest. Come into the hood. Come into the barrio. Come into the schools. Come into the abortion clinics. Come into the prisons. Come and caress our spines. I say, come, wrap your feet around justice. I say, come, wrap your tongues around truth. I say, come, wrap your hands with deeds and prayer. You brown ones, you yellow ones, you black ones, you gay ones, you white ones, you lesbian ones. Come, 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 come to this battlefield called life, 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 called life. I'm going to stay on the battlefield. I'm going to stay on the battlefield. I'm going to stay on the battlefield till I die.
Poetry of Sonia Sanchez. Thank you so much.
Thank you, my dear
Wonderful.
Sister. So good seeing you again.
Yes. You too.
And I look forward to hearing you read tonight also.
Thank you.
Yeah. And thank you, engineer, very much.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Joseph Wilk and Brian Sawarek. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, here on Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP.